Spirit Radio Podcasts.
In Ireland, you know, we're so blessed with our incredible scenery and fortunate to be able to follow pilgrim walks and ancient routes without having to travel abroad at all. So with the government encouraging us all to stay at home in Ireland this summer, which of course makes really good common sense, you might want to consider walking on one of our pilgrim paths. And you might not know all about them, but they include Crowpatrick, Loch Derr, Glendalough and Glencolumbkill. And on the line to tell us more, we have the chairman of Pilgrim Paths Ireland. That's John G. O'Dwyer. John, you're very welcome. I hope you're on the line there.
I am indeed. Thank you very much, Kieran. I'm here and thank you for having me on.
You are so welcome. It's good to have you along. First of all, John, tell us a little bit more about the history of these pilgrim paths in Ireland.
Well, I suppose, I sometimes love saying this to people who go abroad and walk in Spain. It's great that, you know, the Camino is a teenager compared to our paths. I mean, it's a little bit maybe over 1,000 years old since the original pilgrimage was made from Oviedo in Spain, was made to Santiago. So that's when it all started off with the finding of the body of King James south of Santiago. But Irish pilgrim paths go way back. Firstly, they go back right back to the early Christian period. We're 100% certain of that. Places like people would have come in from all over Europe. They would go into places like Clan MacNoise, and then there was also a pilgrimage to Loch Derg as well as that. But if we go back, a lot of these are paths that have been Christianized. So if we go back further, we see the path, for example, in Glencolumbkill. That, in fact, what has happened is they are actually pagan standing stones, and then they have been Christianized. So when Christianity takes over then, but they don't take away the pagans. The standing stones, what they do is they simply put a cross on each one and thereby Christianize it. Of course, the most famous example of that would be the Tohar, which is up in Mayo. Now, it's not the usual way some of your listeners may have gone up Crowpatrick. They would have gone up from path developed at a later stage from Wirras Abbey. But originally, the path which comes in is the Tohar, and it comes into the south of the mountain, and that was there since St. Patrick's time. But again, you go back further and you find that it was a pagan path, and that's, you know, Cuchonaglia, which is the name for the old name for Crowpatrick, that was actually a pagan site. So these paths could be anything. They could be, you know, 2,000 maybe more years old.
So you're claiming they're much more ancient than anything on the Camino.
Exactly, yes.
Okay, now Crowpatrick and that alternate path you talked about, is it any less difficult to climb if you go up that particular
route? No, you just go from the other side. Funnily enough, actually, it's not actually difficult to climb at all, because what you do is, you see, this is the path through the mountain. So what generally happens was people would have gone from abbey to abbey. Now at the moment, the section of the path of the Tohar goes from Ballintubber Abbey, which is the early Augustinian foundation. It would have led from there on then to Ahagower. Most likely people have spent a night in Ballintubber, another night in Ahagower, and then maybe gone on to Murris Abbey. And that's where you don't actually climb it as part of the climb Crowpatrick as part of the Tohar. What you do is you make your way to Murris Abbey, which is on the coast of Clew Bay, and then you would probably have gone up the following day. But that's not actually a requirement even for doing the path today.
That's a relief, because having tried and failed to do Crowpatrick a couple years ago,
I'll tell you one thing, you'd be nice to know that it became very, very loose, and you described titanium sort of accents. What they are now is they're stabilising the path. They're going to use the local materials, put the stones together and stabilise the path up along. So you won't be, as sometimes called skating rings.
I have to say, I found it quite challenging, and then I was watching very elderly people, much older than me and much younger than me as well, little kids, and they were just
coming down now. You're
stressing
one pose. At the moment, you know, in the squeeze, there's a place called the bend, and you want to be very, very careful there.
Absolutely. Now, that's Crowpatrick, and we know some of the other famous ones like Glendalough, etc., but there are pilgrim paths all over the country, John.
They are indeed, and they're particularly strong in the southwest. And down there now we have three paths. And of course, what you can do at the moment is, when people were going out to the Camino, it was about 120 kilometres that most people walked, and that's how they got their Compostela. Well, what you can do in Ireland, you can do something similar. So if you walk the five of the pilgrim paths, we've already discussed the Tohar, but down in the southwest there you have St. Finbar's pilgrim path as well as that, and that's a two-day walk across the Sheehy Mountains. And that ties up then, there's two lovely paths in Kerry. One is Cossáin an Éire, which leads to Mount Brandon, and that of course again was almost certainly not associated really initially with St. Brendan, but with Bran, who was a Celtic god. So you have that there, 18 kilometres, a one-day walk, two-day walk on St. Finbarr, and Canucks na Dubba, which is the Hill of the Wells, which is down in southwest Kerry near Carstaveen. That's another one-day climb as well as that. So what some people do then is they go down to the southwest and they do those three. In other words, we'll say now, this week, you say at August now, there are organised times going, walks going ahead on those. So what will happen is that on the 21st and 22nd of August, people will be led along St. Finbarr's Pilgrim Path. On the 23rd then, they can move on to Canucks na Dubba, and they'll be led up that on the 24th and the Cossan and Nave. And there's been a huge demand for it. I suppose it's pent-up demand for people who can't go out to the Camino. For example, the Cossan and Nave have such numbers that already people are already on a waiting list. But the thing to remember is you want to do it on your own. All the paths are fully waymarked. You can go along and follow it yourself out in your own group. They're open all the time.
What about guidebooks or websites that people can get that kind of information from? How do they, if they want to do that on their own, how do they find out?
That's an ideal question, because I can tell you that I have written a book on the pilgrim paths of Ireland. So all the main paths and all those routes at times discuss are in it. There's a map, there's directions, and I've written all about history as well. So what I was trying to do anyway, and hopefully I got it 90% right, is get all the information for somebody who wants to do it themselves or with their own group. Do it for independent travellers. You have your map there, you have all the, you know, the details of where you go left and right and everything else, and then the severity of the climb and the history as well as that. And that's titled Pilgrim Paths in Ireland by John G. O'Dwyer. It's up on Amazon. But as always, I say, if you can buy it at all, buy it in your local
bookshop. From a local bookshop, I agree with you completely. Yeah. Well, that sounds like a great resource, in fairness.
Well, it's actually been amazingly, it's actually just about, now that you mention it, it's just about to sell out again for the fourth time. So it has actually been, it was reprinted twice, then we brought in a new edition in which we updated it and we put more information into it, and it's just on the point of selling that out as well. So it has been a very, very good seller over a long period of time. These things don't make the bestseller list because they're a long life book. And I brought this out first in 2013. It's still selling well, and I think I'll be doing another edition now as well.
And I think, given what you said about the interest, because people can't go to the Camino and the equivalent walks elsewhere,
that's what we're asking people to do this year, you know, to put on the green jersey. In a way, it's almost a very spiritual thing to do, to support your local communities, get the multipliers going, get down there, walk the path, eat in the local restaurants. They'll buy it from the farmers will buy it from the co-op. It all creates jobs.
It all makes a huge difference.
It's a multiplier effect.
I couldn't agree more. It's a great idea. Now, there's some talk here in the notes I have about a passport. I know that I'm familiar with the Camino and the passport. There seems to be something equivalent that you can get with these walks.
Yeah, there's an Irish Pilgrim passport there as well as that. And what you do is you go along. Now, there's five paths involved in that. The three I mentioned down in Cork and Kerry, St. Finbarr's are there, Canucks na Dubba, and Cossan and Nave. So if you go down and you do that, there's a stamping point then, a shop or a pub where you go and you get a stamp that you have completed. Generally what you do is you show a selfie of yourself on the route.
Okay.
Then what happens is, or you could do this as a guided group as well, and a guide will sign off on it. Then you go up to Glendalough, you can do that as well, sign up there, get your stamp there in the Heritage Centre, and the Tohar. Now, the Tohar hasn't quite opened yet, but it will be open, and you can complete it up there. Go to Ballintrubble Abbey then, and you get your certificate of completion. It's attached to Sillaracta, because this is a completion certificate in Irish. We don't call it a Camino or anything like that, but it's exactly like the Compostela that some of your listeners will know about, that you get when you complete the Camino.
The various stages of the Camino, fantastic.
Well, anyone wants information, I mean, it's all up. It's all up at pilgrimpath.ie. That's
excellent.
So
good website.
All the contact numbers out together are up there.
John, what do people get? What's your experience? What do people get out of taking part in the pilgrimage, doing it for a pilgrimage, rather than just going for a walk or a hill walk or a hike?
Yeah, I think pilgrimage is probably profoundly different. I think people go on a walk for exercise, to like the scenery and to get away from it all. I think, though, at some subconscious level, people are thinking of pilgrimage as some kind of a journey of self-discovery, an inner journey is what they're... I think what they're expecting is, and for a lot of them, they can leave things behind and they can be a different person at the end of the route. I think that's what differentiates pilgrimage. And then people do it for an awful lot of reasons. I think it can be for, you know, maybe they would have a request from God that they wanted, you know, somebody to be cured for an illness or something like that. And they may do that, or they may do it in remembering as well. Someone that they wish fervently could come with them but isn't around anymore. So it, all those kind of things, what I think is cathartic, is a clearing of the spirit that comes with pilgrimage. And people often find at the end of it, you know, that they have started with a heavy load on their back of baggage and they somehow feel lighter and freer. And that's what pilgrimage is about. And of course, it's the very fact then of reconnecting with our ancestors and walking their footsteps. And in Ireland, knowing that they have been doing that for 2,000 years.
Yeah, it's a great sense of history in it, isn't there? And I imagine there are people that set out just going for a walk and the whole thing kind of, you know, has a much more spiritual impact on them than maybe they expected when they tried it. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. I mean, the interesting thing is you get all, you know, an enormous number of people. I mean, it's the new spirituality. I think people don't go into churches as much anymore. They tend to express, I think, my thinking is that spirituality is always around. It's part of human nature. It just takes different manifestations. And at the moment, for a lot of people, it's not going into church. Numbers are falling very much there. But they're increasing out in the outdoors. So that seems to be how people want to reconnect with their spiritual side. They want to go out and they want to do a pilgrim path. And, you know, it's just a new, I suppose, mutation of spirituality in the modern world. And, you know, people will always find that what, you know, a lot of the time what we read the papers and magazines, conspicuous consumption is a thing. You know, having this, having that, having something else is the way to happiness. And of course, deep down we know that's not the way to happiness at all. And of course, the great thing about the pilgrim path is it's a great leveler. It completely simplifies life. You have only one task. You're not keeping five or six balls in the air. You just have to get to the end of this trail and the following day do the same thing. So it takes all the incidentals out of your mind again. So it's a huge simplification of life, I think, that people enjoy. And I think people will often start off, you know, being, oh my God, and rushing along. And then they get into the path, and that's when the change comes about.
Absolutely. Excellent. Listen, John, is there any particular of those paths that you mentioned that would be suitable for maybe for families, family friendly, or for people that aren't really great walkers or aren't really...
Well, yeah, the first thing I would say, yeah, I mean, for example, if you're down in Kerry, I would suggest what you do is you could walk the Cossaw on the Nail, which that's a venture, and it's beautiful. It's a long, you know, very, very... hats, fuchsia-lined green trails and that, and it's all pretty level. And along the way, then, there are castles, there are churches. You go by Galerus Oratory, for example. There are standing stones. There are ancient symbols, spiral symbols of pilgrimage on the rocks along the way. And what I would say is you don't have to walk at all. Just walk over to the beautiful monastery and finish there at Kilmalkade. Or if it's a family walk and you don't have to get hilly after that, you don't want to take kids up the hill. As well as that Knocknadobber, fully waymarked. If the kids are up to it, you can go up and down the hill there as well as that. And of course, Dublin people then, nothing better, go out to either Brownwood, or if you want an easier walk, go to Ballymount. There are two starting times for St. Kevin's, and both lead all the way to Glendalough as well as that. And, you know, they're not too challenging. They would be the ones that would strike me straight.
Excellent. That's great advice and some good things for our listeners to think about doing maybe over the next couple of weeks. And hopefully the weather will pick up and they'll get out a little bit more. John, you've mentioned the book. Mention the name of it again there for us.
Yeah, it's Pilgrim Path in Ireland, A Guide by John G. O'Dwyer.
Very good.
So I've written out five books, and that's about one of them, mostly about hill walking. And then I have written stories from the uplands as well, which has stories of pilgrimages as well. And there are stories, this doesn't have maps in it, but it has stories of what happened in the Irish hills. And I have the full story and history of how the Toha came about up in Mayo, in other words, leading the Cork Patrick, the full story of that, and how it was revitalised again then about 20 years ago. So lots of stories there.
Brilliant.
So you can Google me on Amazon or buying local bookshop.
Very good. Sounds like we'd have to have you back, actually. There's quite a few stories there. We haven't got time to go into now.
I want to talk about that story from the Irish uplands. A lot of them would have spirituality built into life, following the footsteps of St. Patrick, St. Brendan, all of those as well as that.
We look forward to that, John. Listen, thanks for being with us today. And I think people can go to... You said pilgrimpath.ie for the details on the passport.
Pilgrimpath.ie for the details.
John, you're a star. Thank you very much. Great talking to you today. Happy walking. And hope everybody enjoys your book or gets a chance to at least check out some of those pilgrim paths across Ireland. Spirit. Well, you've probably heard or maybe even visited the famous Colmore Abbey in Connemara in County Galway. Our next guest is a renowned historian, has co-authored a new book that gives an illustrated account of the Benedictine nuns of Colmore and how they came to live in Ireland and at the Abbey. The book is called The Benedictine Nuns and Colmore Abbey, A History, and on the line to tell us more about it is its co-author, Deirdre Rafferty. Deirdre is a historian and professor of history of education at UCD. You're very welcome along this morning, Deirdre.
Thank you. Delighted to be with you.
It's a real pleasure to have you. Colmore Abbey is a really fantastic place to visit. Had you a long association with the Abbey before you got the idea to research and write this book?
I didn't have a personal association with it, but I am from the West. I'm a Galway woman, so I knew the Abbey. I think everybody in the West of Ireland knows Colmore.
I think everybody in the country actually
does. Everybody now in the country does. It has become a very, the image of the castle itself has become a very iconic image. So I didn't know it at a personal level until I got to know the Benedictine nuns through other research that I was doing on women religious and convents. And as I got to know them, they were talking about the fact that they have a very big year this year. They're 100 years at Colmore now in 2020. So it was timely to commemorate the year by looking at their records and writing a history.
Excellent. Now, tell us a little bit about the building itself and maybe its history before the Benedictine nuns actually arrived, which is the core of your story, I know. But what was the history behind Colmore Abbey?
Yeah, the abbey itself, the castle as it would have been called before they started to call it an abbey, the castle itself, it has an interesting and checkered history. And we have a whole section in the book with some very beautiful images devoted to the castle and the history of the castle in Connemara. It had been just a very small fishing lodge in the early 19th century, and it was bought by a man called Mitchell Henry. He was a very successful Harley Street eye surgeon, and he was of Irish descent, and he married an Irish woman, Margaret Vaughan, in Dublin, and they had a great love affair. Their love affair is part of the romance of Colmore. He brought her to Connemara on their honeymoon. They began to know the Connemara people over several visits, and he said he would build her a castle. So he eventually came into a substantial inheritance in 1862, and he went and bought the little fishing lodge on the lake, and he bought 13,000 acres around it, and built the castle that we know around this very small fishing lodge. He just kept it in the centre and constructed a big granite neo-Gothic surrounding, and made this extraordinary and extremely luxurious castle with 33 bedrooms and bathrooms, drawing rooms. He knew he was a very sociable, clubbable man. He became an MP for Galway. So he had a ballroom and a billiard room. He had a gun room and a smoking room. Everything that could help him entertain their guests.
Well, so it was a real labour of love.
Yeah, and what is most unusual, and which visitors to the Colmore Abbey can see now when they go down, because the sisters, the nuns, restored the beautiful Victorian garden. He had a vinery, he had a banana house, wonderful glass houses with figs and peaches and nectarines. So for his guests in Connemara who came to be entertained, they were eating foods that had never been grown in that part of the country before, never been seen in 19th century.
It was pretty rare at the time, regardless of where. Yeah.
So it was a very elaborate and beautiful estate. It had shooting, it had oyster beds and fish hatcheries. And he was also a landlord. When he bought the estate, he took on the about 120 tenants that were on the estate and continued to develop the estate. So it became a big employer in Connemara. And interestingly, today in Connemara, Colmore is the single biggest employer of Connemara people, which is a wonderful story.
Absolutely. Now, how did it come into the hands of the Benedictine nuns?
Well, as you can imagine from my description there of the lavish way that he and his wife, and he had nine children, lived their lives, sometimes one can spend too much, perhaps, on the luxuries of life. And he had some economic downturns in the late 19th century. It wasn't unique to him, but he had investments that failed. And he was also considered locally to be a very generous landlord who waived half a year's rents, particularly in the 1870s after famines had caused severe food shortage in his neighbourhood. So partly overspending and partly probably not as prudent a manager of his estate as he had hoped to be, but he had to sell it. And when people visit the estate or read the book, they will realise also his wonderful wife, with whom he seems to have been terribly in love, she died very tragically when he took her and his family on a big trip to Egypt, a cruising trip to Egypt in the 1870s. And after that, I feel, looking at the records, his heart went out of the whole place. You know, she didn't come back with him. He had to have her remains brought home. And he was so devastated by her sudden death in Egypt that he refused to bury her. And he had a Victorian neo-Gothic chapel built on the estate, which is still there, and eventually allowed her body to be interred in a beautiful tomb that was made for her. And really then after that, I think a lot of the spirit of Kylemore may have been gone for him. So he had to sell the estate, and it was bought by the Duke and Duchess of Manchester. And the Duke of Manchester had married an American heiress, Helen Zimmerman, which was...
That's where he got the money to buy it, wasn't
it? Quite fortunate for him, because he didn't have any money either. So, to cut a dramatic story short, they lived a little high on the wire as well, and within a couple of years, they also had to sell off the entire estate.
So it was obviously a house that was inclined people towards a little bit on the excess. Well, with all that opportunity for partying and entertaining, I suppose
there was some of that. And his gambling problems and spending... And not really spending enough time on the estate. I think something that Mitchell Henry did understand was, when you have an estate, you have all the community and the people around it. And that had to be minded.
You have a responsibility as well as a...
A lot of responsibility. So it was up for sale again. It had a brief period where it was belonged to a property speculator who never actually visited it. And then it was put on sale in 1919. And as it happened, at that particular moment, the Benedictine nuns, the Irish Dames of Ypres, as they were known as, were looking for a home. And they had to leave Ypres in 1914 when their monastery was bombed and destroyed. And they had been almost homeless, you could say, as they moved first to England and then to Wexford, and eventually to find their permanent home in Connemara.
What a wonderful spot to end up at the end of all that trouble and strife.
Yes. They had their own great, as you say, great trouble and strife when they had to flee their monastery, and almost everything belonging to them was destroyed in their monastery. Their abbess would not have left the walls of the monastery for 6 years, and suddenly they had to go into exile effectively. They had been at Ypres since 1665, when the foundation had been made. So this was a huge upheaval for the community. And they made their way to Ireland, and they were given care and looked after first in Wexford at MacMine. And then eventually, when Kylemore was up for sale, it presented itself as the perfect opportunity
for them, and a beautiful part of the country to end up in too.
Yes.
Am I right, or have I got this wrong? Was it a school for a long time?
Oh, it was a school, yeah, until 2010, yes. Benedictine sisters, nuns, have always had education as part of their work, their labour and work and prayer. And even when they were at Ypres, they were known as being the Irish Danes that educated daughters of Irish Catholics who went there in the 18th century for their schooling. So when they finally settled here in Connemara, what they decided to do was open a school, which would help to sustain the whole enterprise. And of course, they were farming the land and continuing the sort of ethical, shall we say, what nowadays people would call ethical and sustainable farming that Benedictines have always done.
Okay, excellent.
But yes, they opened a school,
and I presume
it was very successful.
I presume it was a boarding school, given the location.
It was a boarding school, yeah. It was a boarding school. So...
And what did they do now? What have the nuns... Now, the school, you said 2010, it was a school until 2010?
It finally closed, yeah. Boarding schools, really, in Ireland, and in fact in a lot of Europe, have really lost their numbers, principally when education and free education was developed in the country from the 1960s and 70s onwards. The need for boarding schools has diminished significantly, and that would be true of Kylemore. It often attracted girls from other countries. They had Indian princesses at school there. They had pupils coming from Europe, continental Europe, and from different parts of Ireland. But the demand for boarding was waning, and by 2010 they knew it wasn't viable or necessary anymore to keep trying to run a boarding school. It was also extremely costly to run a boarding school.
I can imagine.
So they developed the estate that we all know now and that everybody is welcome to visit. And they restored and opened their magnificent Victorian walled garden, one of the largest and most perfect Victorian walled gardens in Europe. It's really quite a spectacular place to visit. And they've opened, they make soap and they make chocolate. They have a beautiful tea room. And they have a stunning museum and exhibition centre, which was relaunched last year with wonderful digital exhibits and talking portraits. A little bit like visiting Hogwarts. So people visit from all over the world now. It's a big piece of the Wild Atlantic Way to stop at Kylemore Abbey.
Isn't that a wonderful way to for it to have kind of developed and changed and evolved over the years? And it's really nice that the sustainability seems to be still a big part of what the nuns are doing.
Very much. They're very committed to the sustainable and ethical management of the land around them, and they would see it very much as being part and parcel of what belongs to the community around them, which is why it's so important that it is a form of local employment. What they have also done, and they're in the middle of at the moment, is building a new monastery, because the castle as we know it now is open to the public, and their new monastery will be able to welcome people who, I suppose you could say, in the 21st century are hungry for a kind of healing of the human spirit. And the monastery will welcome visitors and people who want to spend time withdrawing for life, just for some tranquility and peace, and spend some time just living in a contemplative environment. So they have another new, I suppose you could say, dawn beginning now in 2020 with the building of their new monastery.
That's a really great story, a great story of hope and survival, indeed, in an absolutely amazing part of the country. You've kind of fallen in love with the place a little bit in the research for the book, I get the impression, listening to you talk about it.
It would be very hard not to fall in love with it. I mean, I know that I have Connemara blood going back many generations, but when I drive out there to do work with them, and you pass the Connemara Mountains and finally arrive out under the Diamond Mountain, it's a very surreal and exquisite landscape. It's a very raw landscape, and then sitting in the middle of it is this beautifully tranquil abbey and monastery, and everybody who walks in the gate says they are suddenly affected by the tranquility of meeting the nuns. You can, if you want, pray with them, or you can, if you don't wish to do that, you can just enjoy it. Enjoy the escape, as they would say themselves, from the stress and brutality of modern life. It can be wonderful to just be in a completely tranquil, safe space.
You paint a wonderful picture of what is, I know, a wonderful place in a wonderful part of the country. We're encouraging everybody now to take holidays at home, and it's probably a great idea for people if they are planning where to go.
It's back open again, which is this week it reopened, and they'll be managing visiting in a safe way because it's such a very vast estate. There's no problem with social distancing when you're walking in a beautiful big grounds. So, yes, they're looking forward to seeing their friends and visitors again.
It's a fantastic story. Wonderful book as well. I have the book here in front of me, beautifully done. Can you tell our listeners about how they could get hold of a copy of your book?
It's released now. It's available through all good bookshops, as they say. It's been published by Irish Academic Press. And it's beautifully illustrated. We're very happy with the work that both the archives provided us with wonderful old photographs. And we had a photographer who did some really stunning photographs down there. Michelle Cooper Galvin spent a couple of days living with the sisters, with the nuns, and photographing them the whole time. So we've some beautiful contemporary images. It's for sale through Amazon and through all good bookshops.
That's brilliant. Well, well done on a beautiful book about a beautiful place. Down the west of Ireland, or really only down the road, we'd encourage people to go and see it. Deirdre Rafferty, historian and professor of history of education at UCD, thank you so much for joining us today on the programme.
Thank you, dear.
And for talking about your book. And I would recommend that one highly. Anyone I know who has ever had anything to do with Kylemore has fallen in love with the place. And it's clear that Deirdre has also fallen in love with Kylemore Abbey.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.